Okay, so it's May 24th, 2017. I'm Rick Hansen, and I say the date because we post these, and I don't know, seems like a wise thing to do. And I want to string together tonight, if I could, several topics related to mindfulness applied to relationships, which is kind of our theme this year, kind of on a roll. And so we'll see how well I do stringing these together. So the first thing I want to do is read to you a little passage from a Wendell Berry poem. And someone's been leaving poetry for me in the Donna basket, along with very good chocolate, and I appreciate it. And maybe later you let me know who you are, because it's all fantastic, the poems and the chocolate. That's not a hint to other people. It really is not. It's just thank you. And part of it's cool. I have no idea who it is. But you can tell me later, or not, either way. Okay, so this is from Wendell Berry, speaking of Green Sangha, deep interest, Wendell Berry, in nature and biology and the interdependence of everything. And there were two sentences in his poem that just popped right out for me. He's writing, I think, in this poem, kind of loosely grounded in a Christian faith tradition. And what he's saying here, though, could have been lifted in many ways right out of the deepest of the deep Buddha Dharma, I think. And the two lines are, move my mind now to that which holds things as they change. Move my mind now, so it's a request, move my mind now to that which holds things as they change. So it's this fundamental consideration that you see, I think, in the deeper teachings and all the traditions of the world. You see this in that deep spiritual tradition that is called quantum mechanics, quantum physics, in which there's a concern with two things: impermanence, passing patternings of something that is stable and unchanging, something that is still. And we could consider that in lots of ways. Ultimately, one could consider that which is eternally still is transcendental. Many people orient to that. Many people don't. I'll kind of stay in a more agnostic view where we just don't know. And minimally, it is clear that in the mind, in terms of passing experiences, there's a sense of awareness as the field, the stable field, through which things change, right? There you are, there's awareness that has a sense of ongoingness, sort of like the grout between the tiles of passing thoughts, sensations, little mini-movies arising in the mind, the space between the thoughts, awareness. And in the neural substrates of consciousness, as best we gather, very fleeting organizations, patternings of synaptic coalitions and related underlying activity, those passing congealings into a kind of eddy in the stream of consciousness, in the stream actually of neural activity, are occurring in a larger field in the brain right now of fertile noise. Neurons, biology, life that's active, metabolism is going on, but in the moment at least, they're not, that field, kind of like a big chalkboard or whiteboard, is not yet patterned into some sound or sight, taste, touch, smell, or thought. So you have in the neurology, which you have in your own experience, these two things, fleeting, impermanent patternings, somethings moving through a field that is stably able to represent them, or to be a field in which they arise and pass away, a field in which they occur. And one can see much the same thing in terms of life. Life as life in this planet, the biosphere altogether, life altogether, as life is stable, even as species and individual organisms, including big sophisticated mammals like us, come and go. You see that combination of the two? It's a great theme, isn't it? Transient patternings of what is continuous. In many ways, I think the great undertaking in ordinary life and in spiritual practice is to work with both of these elements in a life, in the mind, in any moment, and over the course of a person's life altogether. And where this also shows up, interestingly, is in relationships. Recently, I've been having yet again that dislocated and yet really illuminating realization that other people are having a day too. In other words, when I look inside and I see over the course of a minute, one of the nice things about meditation where you get quieter and the capacity to sustain an awareness of what's going by becomes more stable, maybe grounded in something like the breath, so you know what is a contrast to the sensations of breathing. All these little mini movies and, you know, kind of things that try to hook you, little shiny objects going through the mind, worrying about this, fantasizing about that, and so forth. So if you just watch your mind for a minute or 5 minutes, you realize a lot of stuff goes by, right? And weird thoughts, strange reactions, worries, pains in your back, fleeting bubbles of what you would say if you were on Fox News tonight, you know? Or whatever, you know, little things, or what they should have said, or just, I'm just talking about my mind for a moment here. But there's something probably about that other people. So then you flip it around, and you realize, as weird as your own stream of consciousness is, the person next to you is having a similarly strange, interesting, bubbling brew of stuff flowing through, right? Yeah, and isn't that weird? Like, makes you kind of want to not sit so close to him. Maybe. I saw some body language there for a moment. But anyway, yeah, and so then you think, wow, what would be great for oneself that others would do? And you know, you think, well, they would not be so reactive to what's going through my mind because it's just kind of mostly stuff. Or you might think they would, you know, be accepting of me. I'd like that if others were accepting of me. So then you kind of turn it around and you think, wow, what would it be like to sustain a stability of relatedness, of kind of all right relatedness? Maybe not the world's most wonderful thing, but definitely one is not being harmed or attacked or brutalized, invaded, exploited, etc., you know? Okay. And what would it be like to sort of sustain a relatedness, a feeling of relatedness with the other person without particularly reacting to the jingling and jaggling and zigging and zagging of their mind stream going by? And I'll give you an example of that. So around our dinner table, sometimes it happens that we talk about politics. And we live with our son now, 29, very bright. And he gets a lot of his news from Reddit. And my wife gets a lot of her news from MSNBC. They overlap somewhat, but they kind of are different streams, for better or worse. And now we're in a family, we're sitting around the dinner table. And I'll watch our son say stuff, and I'll watch my wife. Really, it's like a pitch in baseball. She wants to swing at it, but she lets it go by. Smart mother, right? And our son's great. Part of it, what he's doing is he's like baiting the hook a little bit, you know, saying things a little deliberately provocative and so forth. And I'm watching her really wisely just sort of not need to hassle it, not need to get into it. I mean, obviously, if something were important and she's not muzzling herself, definitely not that. But non-reactivity to the other person. A different version of that, again, speaking of our son, long-suffering son, when he was young, his sister, our daughter, was like 2 years, 9 months younger, and she would do stuff, you know, kid sister. He'd be like 8 years old, and she would jab him in some way, right? She'd threaten to grab his toy, or she would say something provocative, and he would take the bait almost every time. And after a while, we kind of talked about it a little bit, and it wasn't very effective, but I was trying to explain to him, as a dad, you know, she's doing that, she's baiting the hook, and I made this gesture, you know, she's going like this, and you know, you're taking the bait, is it right there, and you don't need to do that. And I think that's so much of what helps things go better in our relationships, this stability of being with basic goodwill, without needing to get caught up in a lot of the stuff going by. Because just like with us, a lot of the stuff in the stream of consciousness is like old tires and shoes and dirty laundry, you know, flotsam and jetsam in the stream of consciousness just rolling by, right? In the river, and just like we think, you know, it's a lot of crud, you know, a lot of it going right on by. Woo! Same with them. No disrespect. More like equality, right? Your mind stream is as screwed up as mine. That's really freeing to kind of realize that in some ways, that we don't have to necessarily react to it. And I think that's been a really useful thing to think about. Think about the little, if you, again, it's with meditation and with deepening training of the mind, our granularity of mindfulness becomes greater. We're more able to track events in real time on a time scale of half seconds, say, or quarter seconds. The neural substrates of working memory, kind of the equivalent of RAM, you know, in a computer, the little mental chalkboard in the upper, outer frontal regions of the cortex, updates about 4 times a second. It's like a refresh rate of a computer monitor. And that kind of corresponds to our experience, right? We typically track roughly 2 to 4 mental events a second, particularly if your mind's a little quiet and you're not caught by the hook, right? So to come more into the real time with other people and just let those pitches go by while having what a spiritual teacher of mine once called it, a blessing disposition. You know, giving no person cause to fear you, quoting the Buddha, also quoting the Buddha, being peaceable, friendly, and fearless as a stable stance through which momentary patternings go, most of which don't have to be resisted or commented on or made significant. They don't have to be a problem. It's that no problem orientation. Right? We're not allowing abuse, we're not being exploited, but so much of what's going by, honestly, it's not a problem. And yet, the brain, designed through survival, 600 million years evolution of the nervous system, to be a world-class problem solver. That's why we're sitting on top of the food chain, sort of the peak in many ways, but certainly the most, in many ways, powerful species on the planet. The mind has this habit of continually looking for a problem to solve, or a threat to avert, right? Or a relationship issue to obsess about. And instead of that, we can drop into more of a stable, no problem. No problem till it's a problem. It's not a problem till it really, really is a problem. You know? I'm not talking about turning a blind eye. I'm just observing, I think, at least what I see, is that so much of what I will speak for myself, so much of what I tend to react to kind of automatically that's happening around me, I don't really need to take as a problem. I don't need to fix it. I don't need to feel threatened by it. I don't need to make it significant. It's not that consequential. I just kind of let it roll on by. See that idea? And that goes to, for me, one of the most practical things that the Buddha ever really taught about. And he used the metaphor of the first and second arrow, or first and second dart. And he pointed out, living 2,500 years ago, no Advil, right? Lots and lots of discomfort. No modern medicine, not civil society as we would imagine it today with the rule of law. A lot of fighting, a lot of war, a lot of conflict. In that larger context, he pointed out that there is the first start of inescapable discomfort, pain. Most of his examples were physical, but by extension, clearly we could talk about emotional pain, the anguish of losing a friend or a child, or being upset about injustices that are raining down on other people. Feeling really bad when you see, you know, I won't get graphic here, trigger alert, but, you know, when you see something happening in the news, you learn about refugees or people in different situations, you know, naturally that's going to land on the heart. No one would want to have a heart so calm that they didn't get upset about hearing about some tragedy happening to someone. Okay, that's the first start. Over time, we can do things to change conditions around us, to reduce first starts. That's good. Over time, we can train ourselves so that things that used to land as a first start just don't hit us in the same way anymore. It's not that we become numb, it's that they just don't get us. But in the moment, the first start arises, right? But then the Buddha pointed out that there's this space. Viktor Frankl pointed out the same space, when the founder of logotherapy, between stimulus and response. Between the first start, including pain, subtle to terrible, physical or emotional pain, but between that pain, around that pain, we have freedom. We have choice. Because the second darts are the darts we throw ourselves. We take issue with things we don't really need to take issue with. We chase trying to prove a point when that dog will never hunt. There's no cheese down that tunnel. That stone will never give blood. That duck will never fly like an eagle, etc. We chase it, right? Or we beat ourselves up. We ruminate about it. We loop and loop and loop and loop and loop. And that too, in relationships, is such a great teaching. You know, it happened. I can decide, let's say one can decide whether to respond to what the other person did or correct something. Very often, though, that's just second, third, fourth, fifth dart territory. You can just see it. I'm a longtime couples counselor. Been married a long time too, and I've seen and I've participated in so many interactions. A says something, right? It's kind of like a package going over the net to B, right? Like a volley. A sends it across, some kind of messy, normal communication. It's like a whole package of things. B is a choice. What will B respond to? Of the mosaic or the package coming over? Some crud, some neutral, something B could join with or agree with. Or, see, so B has a range of options. What does B often do? Picks the one thing that's most provocative and fires back. Then A, game on already, you know? A is going to respond to that. And then it's like second, third, fourth, fifth, eighth dart, nuclear reaction, boom. And you can see that at the level of kids in preschool, you can see it across a family dinner table. Sometimes the crescendo is very cool and chilly and yet still biting, even lethal. And you can see it scaled up between nations and groups all the level, all the way to war. All right? And what is that? That's like a second dart runaway, like a runaway reaction that would be halted if either party had just disengaged from the second dart material. It's very powerful to name the first dart with dignity. I want to move into that real soon, like what to do. But we don't have to get, we can watch our minds. We don't have to get caught up in these runaways. We can come back to, wait a second here. Is there really a problem? Do I really need to take issue with this? Do I really need to chase that topic? Or as I'm watching my wife, can I just let that ball go by? It's out of the strike zone. I don't have to deal with it. As my father, who grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, born in 1918, real country background, eventually became a fish and game naturalist and a zoologist, a professor. He had this wonderful little gesture. As you may know, he passed away about a year and a half ago, 3 weeks shy of his 97th birthday. So I don't know if you could see me in the back, but he had this little gesture. He'd do this thing with his hand, very North Dakota. He'd just kind of move his hand. Don't fuss with that, Rick. Just you don't need to fuss with it. You know, just kind of the deflector. It's like almost he was this human spaceship with his deflector shields. Just whoosh. He's like super ninja, Jedi Knight, you know, Jedi Master. Just whoosh, whoosh. You don't need to mess with that. And I just think about that gesture. We just don't need to mess with it.
Couldn't you know? See it over
there. Oh, okay. Sorry. Oh, yeah. Body language. See, he's going. It was just like a very natural thing. Well, he literally like a horse flicking away a fly or something. Just, you know, grew up around a ranch with horses. He just, you know, no fuss. Fuss was the word. You don't need to fuss with that. It's okay. And it wasn't dismissive. It was sort of like, trust me, there are bigger problems. You don't need to, it's not worth it. You don't need to fuss with that, right? So you might even imagine for yourself, because it's good to embody it, right? I mean, modeling my father, that little gesture, just, or you imagine just, you just kind of watch it go by, uh-huh, you know? And then you'll even see sometimes other people escalate a little bit because they're trying to get you, because that for them is almost a mode of relating, or it's a great way to divert attention from what's right on the table, which is actually their being inappropriate, right? So our non-reactivity really allows often what's problematic to just kind of sit in the space and smell. It's kind of hard to get away from it when you're not doing anything about it. Just, oh, sits there, you know? So you might imagine that quality. Which then, and this is really going to be a stretch probably, takes me to, but what do you do about terrible things? You know, I've been preoccupied, like a lot of people, with the bombing in Manchester, England. I'm traveling there 10 days, you know, to the British Isles. And I'll be within a couple hundred miles. And just, obviously, bad things can happen anywhere at any time. But it's come close to me. Plus, if one's aware of the world, it's hard to not be aware of some terrible things. And then we think about scaling it down more locally. You know, there are lots of ways that people do things in ordinary life that are that are deliberately mean, if not inappropriately indifferent or neglectful, when people really ought to do something, if it's within their power to do. All right, what do we do about that? How do you hold these truths about balance and spaciousness and a stability in our own place, right? With stuff that seems, everybody has their own list, I have my little list, stuff that really does seem appalling, crazy, ridiculous, evil. Like, if you need to win by killing other people, something's wrong, right? So, how do we put all that together? And it's, I don't claim any kind of ultimate wisdom about that. I find that it's important to be aware of both of these things. You know, the level that I've been talking about, which makes sense to me, and yet simultaneously, how do we preserve what you decide for yourself? Seems sensible or feels right in that approach I was describing with these larger things. So I want to hold this more as a question than as me having a solution or an answer. I will offer or pass along to you a couple of teachings from the Buddha that I think are relevant on this. The first one is very interestingly, even though Buddhism tends to be really seen as like a meditative tradition that's very still and restrained and kind of internal, secluded from worldly concerns is a common phrase, secluded. The Buddha himself, in his life and in his teaching, really emphasized agency. really emphasized taking responsibility, being a light unto oneself, doing what one can, and inheriting the consequences of one's deliberate choices, and therefore make good deliberate choices. So we have this fundamental principle of agency, of showing up and doing what we can. His path was, he walked away from his kind of destiny as a warrior prince, gentleman farmer, more or less, in his time. He walked away from that. He taught a lot about not killing oneself, not profiting from killing oneself in various ways, including non-human animals. And that said, for 40 years, he spoke truth to power. There are very famous stories of him putting his life in the hands of a king that he was confronting, or senior students of his doing much the same, and in the years after the Buddha died. So he certainly was willing, given his role as a renunciate teacher, to take action in his words, certainly, in a political scale. But his primary focus was to function more as a teacher. That said, in his teachings, there was a very strong emphasis on agency. Not sitting on our hands, not sitting on our butt, doing what we can. That's an offering. And so we look to ourselves, and we each have our own answers to that question. What can I do to help this world become a better place? And then we look and we see, and we're moved in different directions depending on our background, our interests, our talents, our capacities. Sometimes our hands are full. There's not much more we can do to make the world a better place than to wearily smile to somebody at the end of a second 8-hour shift, because that's the life we have to live for various reasons. So we do what we can. Second great teaching of the Buddha is really annoying when you're righteously angry, speaking of myself here, about various things. The Buddha said, omitting none with regard to compassion and kindness and benevolence. Omitting none. Radiating compassion and kindness in all directions, as he goes on to say, wishing well to all beings, omitting none, as a mother would wish well for her child, her only child. Omitting none. That's remarkable teaching, isn't it? To realize that, yes, we can put someone out of our business or our marriage or our bed. We can put them out of our White House, and yet we need not put them out of our heart. Omitting none. And I find that aspirational. I've been at this a while. I know there are moments in my mind where I've omitted some, if not many. You know, you can watch your mind tend to do that. So it's aspirational. It's an ongoing practice to extend the circle of us to include all beings, including ones we are opposed to, and to string together more seconds in which we truly are omitting none. Two perspectives: agency, doing what we can, and along the way, omitting none. Okay, so tried to string some topics together here on my way out the door for 5 weeks, so I won't have to deal with the consequences next week, right? Anyway, so what do you think about all that? What do you make about it? Are there practical applications? How does it touch you? Comments, questions? Great.
We worked on contentiousness last week.
Yeah.
And I found myself in a discussion with my wife about the pronunciation of a Spanish word. And I was just trying to think of the Spanish word. But so that's how consequential it was. But in the middle of it, I said, wait a minute, what am I doing here? And I went to a more open-hearted level. And it felt good.
That's great.
And I think it was related. It somehow germinated from last week. It's been germinating for a long time in many other ways too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I think it did germinate from possibly from the contentiousness episode. So.
Yeah, we don't have to. Or sometimes we find ourselves in the middle of that runaway But as soon as we realize that, you know, we can start settling down and asking ourselves, what's the real prize here? We can start reclaiming agency. I don't have to be hijacked by my amygdala or whatever is happening right here and now. What are the real stakes on the table here? Yeah. Other people? Great.
I think one of the things that I think about is, you talk about your kids, is my kids who are similar ages. And and sometimes I've gotten much better at not taking the bait.
Yeah.
But I notice how much that irks them at times.
Uh-huh.
And
right,
notice,
you're blowing up the script.
Yeah, and I notice how much I'm enjoying that. And then I kind of get into this like slightly removed observation of what's happening, and every now and then I think, who am I serving by not taking the bait? Is this part of the developmental process that I should honor? And it, you know, it becomes kind of a dialogue. You know, I get so busy during these moments when I'm silent, you know. But I find it so fascinating to watch that thing that happens between, you know, teenagers or young adults and parents.
Yes, mm-hmm. I know. Funny little story from the book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, about Tom Wolfe wrote it, about the hippies, the early days of the hippies, the merry pranksters, the really fast version of it, because it is this particular moment that I've thought about a million times, and the tagline basically is, whose movie are you in? Right? And so what would happen historically is that 1964, so think about it, civil rights movement, segregation in the South, the merry pranksters, with I think Neil Cassidy at the wheel, wired on speed, rolled down the highway in a giant yellow bus, painted in day-glow colors, reeking with marijuana. I have no idea. I'm rolling down the highway. Inevitably, some cop in some county in Texas or Arkansas or somewhere would pull him over on something. And if you've ever had a traffic ticket, I've had, you know it's kind of like a script. Speaking of a movie, right? It's very scripted. God help you if you disrupt the script, right, or challenge the script. So there's a kind of scripted quality that was described with when the police officer would give him a ticket for something, a brake light out, the license plate was hanging the wrong way, probably often just to hassle him. Okay, you can imagine how that was going. Well, they were making a documentary of their journey across the South in 1964, bunch of hippies in a bus, and they were very polite. They would never, you know, hassle the police officer, but they would put a microphone on, always man, they would put a microphone close to his mouth, they would step back and start taking clearly a movie, and they wouldn't resist him directly, but eventually they would sort of draw him into what they were doing. Could you say that again, officer? I didn't quite catch that, you know? And they weren't making fun of him, they were just doing their thing, and inevitably, almost always what would happen is he would just get flustered and get knocked off his script. He was drawn into their script, and he said, "I just get out of here, get out of here, get out of my county and go." And they would just zoom off, and then eventually this would happen again. So the deep question, I think, often is, whose movie are we in? Who's writing the script here, you know? And what role am I playing in your deal, for better or worse, including I'm in the middle of your bad day, or there's this familiar pattern between us. Like, you've learned how a way to be, I've learned how to be, and somehow I'm caught yet again in this little familiar style of interacting with you, or I'm with a certain kind of person. I've never met you before in my life, but you're a certain kind of person, I'm a certain kind of person, and we know how to do our dance together, which is often full of conflict and suffering for both of us, but wow, is it a familiar pattern, right? So it's great to ask oneself, including with teens and other people, am I getting sucked into your movie? And do I have an option in which I don't need to fight you directly, but I just don't need to presume agency again. I don't need to presume the demand characteristics coming at me from your movie. I don't have to speak the lines. You're running on the teleprompter. That's very potent, isn't it? To step out of their movie. Okay. Maybe one or two final people wrapping up. Great.
Well, okay, so is it to be accepted? Is it to be communicative with somebody else? Is that why I give in to your stuff?
Right. Well, it's a deep question, isn't it? You know, and to me, the answer is rooted in patterns of relating that are grounded in our history as mammals, 200 million years, right? And also, these patterns are grounded in our personal history, attachment styles,
parental,
the way we grew up. And we're designed to learn socially. Arguably, the greatest evolutionary adaptation over the last 3 million or so years, it is considered to be the adaptation to group living, to living with others cooperatively and sometimes aggressively in ways that promoted individual survival, but also promoted the survival of a larger eddy in the stream. That particular band, which had a lot of shared genes, competing with other bands who had shared genes, and the ones that were better at cooperating internally and aggressing externally, sometimes trading externally, tended to leave their genes behind, eventually today, woven into our DNA, right? So, I mean, and so along the way, we're designed to learn from our social experiences. I think of it as a form of learning. I learned that way to be, you learned that way to be, my wife and son have learned that way to be, I have familiar patterns, you know, with other people in my family, extended family. I think of it as learning. And then the question is it helpful learning or maladaptive learning? And then how can we unlearn that way that's not so skillful and learn a more skillful way of being? And I guess I go back again to this line from the Buddha that I've thought about so many times, in which he said, or it's said that he said, wisdom is choosing a greater happiness over a lesser happiness. It's easy to choose happiness over unhappiness, but a greater happiness over a lesser happiness. There's a lesser happiness, there are rewards, there's payoff. The payoff of simply familiarity, that familiar script, that movie we know well. You know, I know how to do that. You know, a friend of mine has a line, be it ever so crappy, there's no place like home.
Oh,
you know, right? So it's familiar. And that's rewarding. There are other times there are payoffs, including righteousness or, interestingly, you know, contentiousness or other patterns like that, or a way to relate while preserving an optimal distance. You know, a lot of relatedness takes this form. Hello, you know, we reach out and we lean back in the same moment. It's a two-for-one deal. So bickering or contentiousness or forms of subtle tension or argumentativeness or, you know, two people, each of whose thought balloon is like a bill of particulars, a case about the other person, right? And yet they're still together. It's a very interesting way to stay connected while preserving a distance for a variety of reasons, including that's what was necessary to be safe as a child, maybe growing up. So a lot of payoffs in these dynamics. And then for me, the question is how to step away, how to step out of the movie, if you will, with the lesser payoff, the lesser happiness, and step increasingly into a greater happiness, a higher happiness for oneself for sure, and probably others as well. That's a lot to choose. And for me, well, that's a good one, good run. All right, y'all, okay? So how about you, so quick, recap, you know, patternings of what's stable, impermanence in a field of relative stability, right? Including this ongoingness of relatedness. Very often, we're fine, they're fine, we're okay. You know, but to feel that, to feel the ongoing okayness of relatedness with various people or just strangers here, you know, people who are not that well known to you, say. And then, you know, ultimately, claiming agency and omitting none from our own heart while doing what we need to do, including speaking truth to power. All right, how about we sit for a minute, let it sink in, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you very much. There is the ongoingness of our relatedness. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I just stand.